The Leslie Marshall Show, the only true democracy in talk radio, of, for, and by you, the people. Live nationwide and streaming live at LeslieMarshallShow.com.
You're free and back in action. I'm Leslie Marshall, back from a vacation. And I got to tell you, when you travel halfway around the world, I don't know if I'm just becoming a really old broad, but whew, I am so jet lagged. I've been jet lagged for 2 days now, and it doesn't seem to be getting better. I don't know. If you have any remedies for that, let me know. More than a pleasure to have back with us today, Scott Paul. Scott is president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, and the AAM is a partnership established by some of America's leading manufacturers, including the USW, the United Steelworkers Union. For nearly 20 years, Scott and the AAM have worked to make American manufacturing a top-of-mind issue for voters. You know, they've done that already. You see manufacturing as a headline on a daily basis now. And our national leaders, and they've done it through effective advocacy, innovative research, and a savvy PR strategy. Please check out their website, plethora of information there, AmericanManufacturing.org. Follow them on X at KeepItMadeInUSA for the AAM, and follow Scott on X at Scott Paul, AAM. Hey, Scott, welcome back. I saw you were doing some traveling yourself. I think I saw that on Facebook. I was trying to stay off email and stuff, but you know, you got to catch up or it's insane when you get back, right?
Of course you do. And Leslie, I feel the same way about jet lag. I read about and hear about all these hacks to like avoid it. And they've been 100% unsuccessful for me as well.
No, me too. We went to Dubai, right? And we live in Los Angeles, and you know, going there, it was lovely. It was a breeze. It's like we ate, we slept, we woke up, we ate a little more, we were there. Coming back was not the case. Coming back was much worse. I was jet lagged the first day, and my kids were fine. My son, like, I think stayed up the whole, I think my son's been up for 2 weeks, you know, and teenagers, you know, and that diet soda, right? And, or caffeinated soda. And my husband has this idea that he will do the time where it is. And what I do is I don't do the time where it is till I get there. So for example, when we landed, I just woke up and had breakfast, but it was 7:30 at night. So we stayed up to like 1 a.m. and my husband was messed up because for him, it really was 1 a.m.
Right. Yeah.
So in other words, instead of eating on the plane and doing all the stuff, you know, because I used my points, so we flew business class, wiped out all my points, you know, and, you know, we're on Emirates and, you know, they feed you every 5 minutes. So, and, you know, it's not the time to diet, you know. So anyway, my husband went to sleep and missed all the great, you know, food and, you know, stuff that they brought around. But I agree with you. I've tried every hack in the book and no, it's not working. The first day I got back, Sunday I woke up and it was like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Yeah. And I'm like, huh? But we're not here to talk about jet lag. We'll do that show another day, Scott. You and I maybe can come up with that'll be our next chapter in our lives, right? You know, solving the jet lag problem. Right. Anyway, let's talk about manufacturing's zero nominal jobs growth this past month in March. That data was released by the Bureau of Labor Statistics last Friday, and it demonstrates the sector's ongoing struggles. So first of all, was this expected? Is this worse than expected, or is it even better than expected? Because, you know, some might say, well, better zero than a big number for job loss. Job growth. Did I say job loss? See, jet lag. Manufacturing zero nominal jobs growth. There's not the growth, but are we in a negative? Are we in a deficit situation looking at this report with regard to manufacturing and these jobs?
Yeah, Leslie, thank you for asking that. I think that there's a couple of things that stand out to me. One is that in general, the overall jobs reports for all the industrial sectors have been good, right? And we had another good one. It was like, I think about 300,000, right? And so it was a pretty good number for March. And so in that respect, it stands out because it's certainly not keeping pace with the rest of the economy. The other reason why I think it stands out is that even though we have seen massive investments in new industries like clean energy manufacturing, so solar, wind, EVs, cars, like semiconductors through the CHIPS Act, or for the firms that are going to be supplying into the infrastructure build out, so those that would build like fiber optic cable and steel, right? That hasn't shown up so much in the jobs numbers. I think eventually it will. I just don't think we're there yet because some of those investments take a little bit of time to actually get on the ground. And so there's a lot of construction jobs building these factories, but the factory workers themselves aren't in them. Yeah.
You know, it's interesting you say that. You must have read my mind, because I was going to ask you, if you had to predict, do you think we're going to see, zero change and become a positive number and be more on par with the kinds of numbers that we're seeing with other industries, other sectors? Right. Yeah. In this report, on the whole, because, you say that we do know that people will say, infrastructure was passed, and we sometimes don't see the benefit of the fruits of those labors until later.
Yeah. And I think that's exactly right. I do think that the actual, factory jobs that we're going to see out of this are going to come later this year, are going to come next year, are going to come in 2026. So they're going to be there. What I do think is holding us back, and is something, a couple of things that are beyond like Biden's control, basically. One of them is what the Federal Reserve Bank does with interest rates. And the higher the interest rates, the worse things are for creating manufacturing jobs, just because that sector is very capital intensive. So there's a lot of borrowing. And when you raise borrowing costs, you're going to essentially get less out of that. So that's one thing. And then the other thing, and this is kind of like one of these paradoxical things, is that the U.S. economy is performing so well in so many different ways. And I'll stipulate that not everybody feels that evenly, but we're doing reasonably well. In particular, compared to the rest of the world. And when you look around the world, I think almost every other country in the world would say, we want an economy like the United States right now, because it's humming along. And we're all having problems, either bigger in problems with inflation, or bigger in problems generating economic growth, or higher unemployment. And what that means basically is, because we don't operate in a vacuum in the United States, we do have trade. It means that we have a harder time selling our products abroad because the markets are a little smaller. And then also these other countries, to keep their own employment going, they're not selling as much at home. So they're trying to send it to the United States, and that might displace some workers here. So I think those factors, interestingly, are kind of working against manufacturing employment right now. And that's, that's hard to have a conversation about on like a morning talk show or whatever, because it's kind of wonky and people don't see it. But I do think that that's one of the reasons why we're seeing that right now.
And the other thing is, not that there's been no growth at all, but over the past year, 24,000 jobs, it sounds like a lot, but it really isn't. Then again, it's a lot better than what it was and it used to be. I'm not trying to be Pollyanna here, but, the momentum is slow, but there is momentum and we're moving in the right direction. And correct me if I'm wrong. Like you said, I want to quote you, You said while the economy continues to generate a sizable number of new jobs, few of them have been added in factories over the past year. The flat manufacturing jobs number for March reflects that. I believe there is a ceiling on factory job growth as long as interest rates remain so high, the dollar remains so strong, and the goods trade deficit stays so persistent. So we are moving in the right direction. And because these numbers in other sectors are so large, and it seems to be exceeding economists' predictions month after month. So, you know, Bidenomics is working, even though people don't like to, you know, use that phrase even on the left anymore. And you would predict it it's going to get better. This is moving in the right direction. And many would say the Feds are going to have to drop the interest rates at some point when you keep having these kinds of numbers.
I think that's right. I think that they will need to do that. But I also think it's worth mentioning that manufacturing, Bidenomics is generally working for manufacturing. I mean, we recovered more than all the jobs that were lost in manufacturing during the Great Recession. That's the first time that's happened in an economic downturn, basically in our lifetime. So that's something worth keeping in mind. So I do think that there's some hope. I think that there's, and I think the future looks brighter than it does right now. And it's not dire right now, but I just think it looks better in the future.
Yeah, I would agree with you. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with Scott Paul, president of the AAM, back after this. We are back. When I say we, it's not just me, Leslie Marshall, but also Scott Paul, president of the AAM. Check out their website, AmericanManufacturing.org. Follow him on X at Scott Paul, AAM, and follow the AAM at Keep It Made in USA. Scott, so glad to have you with us. I know we had a little technical snafu, but that's behind us. So let's move forward and onward to China and talks that Secretary Yellen's going to be having with senior leadership in Beijing. I had read your quote talking about that there's more business than usual from the United States, that U.S. remains a market very open to imports. That's backed up by trade data that was released last Thursday by the Census Bureau. And, you know, you at the AAM urge and you know, along with so many who are, you know, get rid of our trade deficit with China and use our upper hand when we can. You strongly feel that this is an advantage that Treasury Secretary Yellen should press as she enters discussions with that leadership about their nation's overcapacity, correct? And explain that for folks that may not fully understand.
Absolutely, Leslie, I'd be happy to. And it makes me wonder whether Secretary Yellen gets jet lag as well, as she travels. I'd love to know her secrets, but she did go to Beijing. She had these series of talks over the last couple of days. And when I previewed it, as you indicated, Leslie, I did say that I thought we had some leverage, in part because of our own economic circumstances, the fact that China and other countries are so dependent on our market for some of their own economic growth. And also that I thought it was really interesting that she, ahead of all of this, actually lifted up and said, we're not going to do business as usual anymore. We know that in some industrial sectors, like autos, that you have way more factory capacity than you're ever going to utilize for the Chinese market alone. Those vehicles or whatever will find their way here, and they'll displace workers in the United States. And I thought it was important just because Secretary Yellen is held in high regard in China and around the world. And so in a lot of respects, really the perfect the perfect Biden official to deliver that message to the Chinese.
Now, the U.S. Real goods trade deficit rose by $1 billion or 1.2% in February, according to that U.S. Census Bureau report. So that people understand, is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? Who's it good for? Who's it bad for? Because people read a lot of words. I'm one of them when it comes to trade deficit and economic jargon, and don't fully understand the impact that has on our nation on jobs in sectors like manufacturing.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is not, I would say it's complicated sometimes. And I'll stipulate that not all deficits are bad, right? You know, if you hear the word deficit, people are like, oh, well, that's gotta be a terrible thing. That's not necessarily true, but in this case, it's not optimal. And what matters is how much it's growing or shrinking and the reasons why it's growing or shrinking. Okay. And so
one thing here, though, one of the reasons that this is, you know, an ace, if you will, up the sleeve of Secretary Yellen is without us buying their goods, they're in trouble. We certainly want more of them buying our goods, and we need to have more goods here, you know, produced here, you know, manufactured here. But at the same time, you can always say, you know, well, we're going to stop that. We're going to heavily encourage our consumers not to buy anything made in China.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's the point, is that the China depends more for its own economic growth on exporting goods to the United States than the opposite, than we do to China. And so we do have the leverage in all of this. Now, there are some goods that are used as inputs in the United States that we have no substitute for right now that we need. And that's part of what this administration and others have been trying to do, is to get more of those critical supply chains back to the United States. But the fact that we are, you know, some of the criticism being leveled at the United States or at the Biden administration right now is like, well, you guys are subsidizing your own industries. You have some tariffs up. That makes you a bad actor. And the truth is far different than that. We're finally defending our own interests, which is good. And there's still an awful lot of imports that come into the United States. In fact, this trade deficit that you talked about, if you scale this out for an entire calendar year, we import or bring into our country probably about $1 trillion more goods than we ship out. And so that is pretty profound. And, you know, that's something that if we shrink that even by, say, 25%, that's going to mean a massive amount of manufacturing investment in the United States. And so that was one of the reasons why I thought Secretary Yellen had a bit of leverage headed into those conversations she was having with Chinese officials.
Can you give us one example of something that the United States has to import from China that we don't produce here?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are some active pharmaceutical ingredients in medicines where we depend on a lot of sources from China, and some of the medicines themselves. Some of those include some antibiotics or some blood thinners, for instance, that would be a real problem. For industrial applications, there's some types of chemicals, there's some types of materials that go into battery production, like the graphite that's in lithium ion batteries that we utilize in the United States. There is more than 90% of that comes from China right now. And so that would have an impact, and the solution, and I, you know, look, this is something that we're aware of, and we're trying to get more of it into other places so that we're not, you know, quote unquote, held hostage at any point. But it is, yeah, we do have some vulnerabilities in that respect ourselves.
The trade deficit with China back in February was $19.9 billion. Trade data shows China is increasingly exploiting Mexico's trade relationship with the U.S., and they're doing that to dodge American duties and tariffs. And in February, the U.S. trade deficit with Mexico hit $13.5 billion. So tell us about that dodging of duties and tariffs, American duties and tariffs, with China exploiting Mexico.
Yeah. So, you know, we have a free trade agreement with Mexico. It's called the USMCA. And it allows goods that are produced in Mexico to come into the United States tariff-free, so no tariffs at all, as long as there's some domestic content. So what China has figured this out. And so Chinese companies are investing in China, and they're sending their products from Mexico instead of from China, which, by the way, there's a 25% tariff on some products coming from China. And so they're using this as kind of a backdoor into the United States. And this is something that's starting to raise alarm bells in the U.S. with policymakers from both parties, especially when it comes to high value things like automobiles. We've got to keep an eye on this, Leslie.
Absolutely. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back more with Scott Paul, more with you. Scott is president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Check out their website, AmericanManufacturing.org. Please follow him on X at Scott Paul, AAM, and follow the AAM at Keep It Made in USA. Back after this. We are back. I'm Leslie Marshall. He's Scott Paul, president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Check out their website, AmericanManufacturing.org. On X, follow the AAM at Keep It Made in USA and follow Scott at Scott Paul, AAM. Scott, thank you for holding. Welcome back. Before we move on to EVs, I want to read something else that you said. Quote, the goods deficit with Mexico, to our last segment and talking about this trade deficit with China and them, using Mexico for their own good to avoid tariffs and such. The goods deficit with Mexico continues to grow as China makes more factory investments there to take advantage of the terms of the USMCA. You said the Biden administration should augment and maintain Section 301 tariffs on Chinese imports, ensure China doesn't benefit from investments made under the IRA, CHIPS Act, and infrastructure laws, and close the door on Chinese auto imports, no matter the country of origin, before they swamp our auto workers. Can you speak to that? And it's not just China, because we're seeing this very cheap EV, we'll get to EVs, from Vietnam, that I'm seeing some of my friends who need to get their teenager a car and they want to do it cheap because it's, you know, oh, it's electric. It's not a Tesla, but it's $219 a month, or I can buy it for 19 grand or something like that. Can you speak to that before we move on to, you know, EV and, you know, whether China's going to flood the globe with EVs?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So I think that this is the issue, is that I'll talk to the policy because I know we'll get to the autos more specifically and the EVs more specifically later. But the policymakers do have important decisions to make. And one of those is that at a time when we're trying to build up these industries in the United States, and for a variety of reasons, they might have gotten a later start here. And some of that is because of public policy. There's a lot of different reasons for it. Okay, so we need to have those measures in place as we're growing these up. And this is just because they're very vulnerable right now. You know, things cost a little more when you're just starting up, and then you eventually can bring the cost down. But that's not where we're at right now, and you just have to work out the kinks when you're earlier in the process. So there's all sorts of reasons why we need to keep some of those tariffs in place. And also, Leslie, why we need to make absolutely sure that the money that the federal government is investing in our economy, and it is massive now because of the infrastructure law, because of the CHIPS Act, and because of the clean energy law. When you combine all of that, that's going to be like basically $1 trillion of public investment that's going to leverage a lot more. We want to make sure that those resources, that those public resources, are going to support companies that are making things in the United States. Because, yeah, it would be easier, for instance, for a state like California, in some ways, if it wants to meet its EV goals of, like, you know, converting all to EVs within a certain amount of time, to just bring a bunch of cheap ones from like Vietnam or China or somewhere else. That would ultimately, in my view, be counterproductive, because we will probably be a lot poorer as a country because of the jobs that we will lose. And the political support for making a dent in climate change will go down too, if people think we're just trading foreign oil for more foreign cars, right? And that a bunch of our industrial communities are wiped out. So I think that's important. So maintaining those tariffs is one key aspect of that. And the other key aspect of that is making sure that the investments that we're making in those industries of the future, which I strongly support, are invested in manufacturing in the United States, and that we're not bringing that stuff in from Vietnam or China or anywhere else to try to meet some of those goals.
Yeah, so let's talk about what's behind the latest U.S.-China fight and whether China's going to flood the globe with EVs and green tech. China is producing electric cars and other green technologies at a record pace. It's become a flashpoint in the new U.S.-China trade fight. And we'll get to the trade fight, you know, portion of that. But how is the United States going to compete with China, Vietnam, and other countries that are making cars like the T-shirts 3 for $10? Because cost is a huge issue. You see the polls, even though I'm dating myself here. When I was a kid, there was leaded and unleaded gasoline. And I remember, I remember people going crazy because they were going to get rid of leaded. And you are all going to have to use unleaded. And it was like the sky is falling. And oh, my God, because we as human beings can't stand, and I think Americans even more, change. Right. We
don't. Our engines are going to knock if there's no lead in the gas. Right. Yeah.
Right.
I remember that.
So now we're all like, oh, everybody uses unleaded unless, you know, you have that big truck. Or I think it's Jaguar that use diesel. Right. So. You know, the reality is that someday we will not have gas stations and cars going to gas stations. I know that scares some people because it's change, but that's the evolution. That's what's going to be progressing, not just in the United States, but pretty much worldwide. And if people, you know, and you see the polls that the majority of people don't want, you know, electric vehicles, probably because they're scared, because it's new, because it's change.
Yeah.
I'm one of those scared, you know, people scared, although I know it's something I need to jump on board with, you know. How is the auto industry going to survive that? Because we know that American EVs are going to be safer. They're going to be better made, you know, sturdier. I mean, the list goes on. But when you have people out there, you've got a couple of kids, I've got a couple of kids, and, you know, they need to get a car if they're going to commute to their job or commute to college or even commute to high school, depending on, you know, how far your school is. And if they have buses, sometimes it's actually cheaper to lease a car than the bus, you know, cost if you don't have a public school system that you send your child to. So how does the American auto industry and how does America, you know, compete with Vietnam and China? China's supposed to put out an EV that's going to be $14,000, right? Mm-hmm. Vietnam has put out an EV that right now, because a friend of mine got one for her daughter. She's a single mom, doesn't have a lot of money. You know, she's a struggling actress, which means sometimes waitress, right, out here. And she said it was $200 a month. And when they're done, they can buy it for $19,000. You know, but what's the kid driving and how safe is that vehicle? So could you speak to that? Because that, you know, that's a reality. That's a fear.
Yeah, it is. And there's a lot to unpack there. I totally agree with you that at some point, everybody's going to be driving an EV. Okay. The only question is how fast that's going to occur and who's going to be manufacturing those EVs, right? So where they're going to be coming from. And do we want it to be? I'm just going to throw in. You brought up the shift in gasoline and all the And I remember. Yeah, I'm also old enough to remember that and the confusion and the concern and all of that.
I remember my grandmother saying, "If I'm going to be forced to buy unleaded gasoline, I'm not going to drive anymore."
Yeah, right.
I mean, why?
Exactly. So to that point, I can think of another analogy too. And that's smartphones in that, you know, we had the rotary dial phones and then we had the touch tone phones for those folks who were really brave. And then we had smartphones and initially people looked at them, you know, and I specifically remember like, you know, seeing the movie about the BlackBerry executives were like, no one's going to want to touch their screen like that. And, everybody has a smartphone now, right? Everybody has a smartphone. And so we're going to get there and we're going to break down those barriers. But a couple of important points. It does matter to me where these things are made because I care a lot about American jobs. And this transition is not going to be a particularly easy one, quite honestly, for manufacturing because the internal combustion engine vehicles have a lot of parts. EVs have fewer parts. That means essentially fewer things that are required to go into it. And we're behind. You know, we're so far behind Asia and Europe in this. And so we know we can do it because guess what? We invented all these technologies and we had electronic cars here a long time ago. So we actually know how to do this stuff. We just have to get it ramped up at scale and we got to get the infrastructure in place. So instead of seeing a gas station, you'll see one of the EV charging stations and like a parking lot of a grocery store or when you go shopping. So when you come back out, it's fully charged and that'll be awesome. But we're not quite there. We're in the transition mode. And I think that is really kind of the unsettling part for a lot of people. But there are reasons why this transition has to be successful. Jobs is one of them. Our climate future is another. And so there's a lot at stake, Leslie.
Absolutely. We're going to take a break and we'll come back and unpack some more of that and also get some advice from Scott Paul and the AAM on these Chinese auto imports. Don't go away. We are back. I'm Leslie Marshall, and he is Scott Paul. He's president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Check out their website, AmericanManufacturing.org. Follow him on X at Scott Paul, AAM, and follow the AAM on X at Keep It Made in USA. And we want to do that, especially with EVs, solar panels, batteries, because China is one up on us right now, and we need to change that. Scott, thank you for holding. Welcome back. So much to talk about. With regard to China and to EVs. For more than a decade, there's been subsidization of automakers. China has built a substantial car industry. They actually account for 60% of the global electric vehicle sales. Some estimates say they're producing as many as 10 million more electric vehicles annually than they can sell domestically. That's according to you guys at the AAM. So, yeah. Scott, we talk about this as a threat. Is there any way that the United States can catch up? I mean, we have to, don't we?
Yeah, we can. We absolutely can. And we're starting to see, like, those policies have just been put into place. It's not like, you know, we have, you know, it's not like you can just add water, stir, and you have a new ecosystem for manufacturing or the way that we drive cars in the United States. It takes a little bit of time, but we're now down that path. Okay. And we know that we can be successful, and we know it for a couple of different reasons. First of all, there's already been, love or leave the owner, I'll give you that. But there's always been a really epically successful auto EV manufacturer in the United States by the name of Tesla, right? That was the world's leading producer of EVs up until BYD from China just overtook that. So we know how. And look, the Detroit Three have been through all sorts of up and downs over their corporate lifetimes, and they've managed to weather them all. And they've done really well, and they know how to make, you know, pickup trucks and SUVs. No one knows how to do it like they do. And so I'm confident that we can get this done, and American workers are eager to do it. And now we have a policy that says, let's bring the batteries here. Let's incentivize consumers to buy some of these vehicles. And the thing that's going to get in the way is either this idea that somehow it's better to have that, you know, $14,000 EV from China now and sacrifice all the jobs that can come along with it, when we'll eventually get to our, you know, we'll get to our climate goals and, you know, the industry is committed to doing that. But there's a right way to do it, and then there's a wrong way to do it. And as I mentioned before, Leslie, public support for climate initiatives will just plummet if people see jobs leaving the United States. It will just totally plummet. And so it is not worth taking that risk. But the, you know, you just in the, when you set this up, you tied together all kind of the segments of the show, which was, you know, China's overcapacity in EVs, in solar panels. It's all very massive. And they see the United States as this, you know, this market just basically to be exploited. And our companies, before they even get a start here, could get wiped out if we do not push back against that. And I want to say, it's not us being protectionist. We consume a lot of stuff here. The problem is not that, or the problem is not that we're wanting to put up some barriers. The problem is that the Chinese government doesn't have policies to make sure its own people can buy what they want, when they want, and feel comfortable with that money. Chinese people tend to save the money because the government, you know, is really so heavy-handed and autocratic. And so it's they made their own bed on this, and we shouldn't be the ones to kind of bail them out. And so I'm glad that we're pursuing the more aggressive policies that Secretary Yellen articulated and that we've seen, because it is important that we get it right. And I hope also, and I'm going to say this a little tongue in cheek, that all of those climate activists, and many of whom I know and love dearly, will buy an American EV, because that would also make a pretty damn important statement about where we need to go on this and how we need to get there.
Well, you had talked about risk. There's also a risk to, you know, I say it, but it's true. You buy three T-shirts for $10. You wear it once, it falls apart in the wash. Do we really want to be putting our children, our, you know, our babies, ourselves at risk, you know, because we save money on the car in the short term, you know, but how much repair is there going to be? How much damage is there going to be if they're not built sturdy enough to withstand somebody hitting you at 60 to 70 miles per hour on the freeway? I mean, that's a reality. How many more people are going to be in the ER? Certainly that will help my husband's business, orthopedic surgery, but we don't want that, you know? How is this different from previous trade fights with China, Scott?
Well, it's different in that the scale matters, like how China's a lot bigger economy than it was 10 years, 20 years ago. So anything that it does has a bigger impact by virtue of that. And the second reason is that the auto industry is so central to so many other types of manufacturing. And just consider this. You know, think about all the steel that's part of an automobile. And actually, you know, autos is probably the largest single market other than construction for steel. Okay. Or think about the glass, you know, that's in an automobile, or the tires that go on, or the semiconductors that go in it, or all of the parts that go into that too. And so it impacts more other jobs around the economy and touches a lot of jobs that people don't even think about. So I think that's...
Yeah, and if we see bridges fall apart made with Chinese steel, what happens to a vehicle made with Chinese steel?
Right. Yeah, and just, you know, beyond the quality concerns, and I'm thankful that you can't just bring anything into the United States and then run it on the road, that it has to get a certification from the National, you know, Transportation Highways and Safety Administration. But even with that, you know, cheap ain't good necessarily when you're out on the road, right? And
there is something to you get what you pay for.
Yeah, it's much harder to hold those companies accountable if they're in Vietnam or if they're in the United or if they're in China rather than if they're in the United States.
And that brings
much
up another
more
point. Who's building them? Do you have children working there? Do you have, you know, people who are being treated like indentured servants or, you know, even slaves, if you will?
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because there have been a number of studies, academic studies that have been published that have shown how deep the automotive supply chain in China in particular is and how enmeshed it is with forced labor in Xinjiang province, which is where the Uyghur population, it's a Turkic ethnic minority, is basically subjugated. In fact, we called it a genocide. So there's a lot of Chinese companies who are knowingly or unknowingly getting supply from forced labor, and that is not fair. And we do know also, just to your broader point, Leslie, that working conditions are better in the United States than they are in a country like Vietnam or in China, and that at least in most parts of the United States, there are active trade unions that are able to look out for their members. There's there's accountability through health and safety laws. And in many of these other places, you just don't find that same system of regulation. So there is that cost, and that's why some of these vehicles are so cheap, because there is not that cost factored in to it at all.
Lastly, what's next? I mean, how do we get ahead of this, ahead of the game?
Yeah, well, we have to keep the investments we have in place. We have to keep the tariffs we have in place. We have to make sure that China can't use that backdoor through Mexico. And we do have policy recommendations that we did as part of this report on Chinese investment in the auto sector. And it makes 11 very specific policy recommendations that the administration, that Congress should take. And so I'd invite people to take a look at that. It's AmericanManufacturing.org. And we have the auto report up there. But that's one thing that we're going to have to do. And we just have to make sure that we're staying that course and that we're doing clean energy manufacturing the right way in the United States to achieve our economic goals, our national security goals, and our climate goals at the same time.
Always enjoy having you with us, Scott. And I also learn a lot every time you're with us, so I appreciate it. Scott Paul,
thank you so much.
President of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. As Scott just mentioned, you can check out their website to find out more information. There's a lot of information there. You want to be an educated consumer, and you want to support America. You want to support the jobs here, not the jobs in China. Go to AmericanManufacturing.org. Follow them on X at Keep It Made in USA. Got a lot of tidbits on there as well. And Scott's page, follow him on X at Scott Paul AAM. I'm Leslie Marshall. Marky Mark Grimaldi is our executive producer. And we thank Scott for being with us today. We hope you have a great one. And hopefully the next time I talk to you, I won't be jet lagged.